Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. This show is heard on WBCQ, The Planet, every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and also on Thursday night, 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. You can also hear this show on Podomatic. Just go to podomatic.com and put up in the search engine there, Camp Constitution, and not only will you find this show, most likely, within a few days of the broadcast, but also a lot of our archive shows, plus some other timeless classics. And please, if you go to Podomatic, please follow our page. The more followers we get, the more listen, the downloads, and et cetera. And you can also hear the show on our YouTube channel, Camp Constitution. Many of our radio shows are also archived there. We just convert to video, and instead of having, you don't see early picture of me, thank heavens, you see a lot of maybe pictures of topical issues during the conversation. And also IPMNation.com on Saturday mornings, I think at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And IPM Nation is a 24-hour online news service. Comes out of Concord, New Hampshire. This show was brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp, and we also have a weekend camp that we added to our portfolio, the summer camp. The family camp is August 5th to the 11th in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and we have a great lineup of instructors, as we do every year, including Lord Christopher Monckton, Professor Willie Soon, Dr. Duke Pester, and Mrs. Chris Ann Hall. And you can learn about that on our website. You know, we have our prices are very reasonable. We're a not-for-profit entity, so pretty much what the camp charges us is what we charge, and we do have tuition available. We just started a weekend camp that will take place in Damascotta, Maine, which is coastal central Maine, the weekend of September 4th to the 16th, Friday to Sunday. And you can just go to our website. We don't have an online registration for that camp, but you can just contact us and we'll send you the information. Well, folks, my wife and I have not attended a movie, a regular going to a theater, in probably about 6 years. The last movie that I think we went to see was the King's Speech, which was highly recommended, and even though we're not big fans of the royal family of England, it was entertaining. It was an interesting movie. But we did see Chappaquiddick recently. That is the movie about the infamous incident that happened in July of 1969 when Ted Kennedy basically committed manslaughter, at the very least, of Mary Jo Kopechne. Now, it's interesting that it took Hollywood 10 years after Kennedy passed away to do a movie about him. Hollywood has been mesmerized by the Kennedy mystique, the Camelot court, and what have you. So it was very interesting that they would do a relatively accurate movie about Kennedy's Chappaquiddick ordeal, his cover-up, his interest in preserving his legacy, his potential candidacy for the president. That was more important than the life of a young idealistic woman who dedicated her life to her brother. And according to the movie, that Kennedy wanted Mary Jo to work for him. So I'll give you a short little review. And again, I'm not a big movie guy, and Hollywood generally gets it wrong, but this time, it seemed to be a relatively credible job. The movie did not depict the mother. It was very interesting. The father, Joe Sr., was played by Bruce Dern. And, of course, at that point, Joe Kennedy Sr. had a stroke, and he was in a wheelchair and pretty much incoherent. And according to the movie, it looks like old Joe played a role in the cover-up. I don't know if that's the case or not. Mary Jo, now there is two different, this is what happens when there's cover up and lies, where the truth is not, and of course, who could believe a Kennedy anyway, but people speculate, well, were they having an affair, well, since there was no autopsy, maybe Mary Jo was pregnant, and on and on. And it's a shame because according to most accounts, Mary Jo was a, you know, a morally upright lady. She was an ideologue, and I'm hoping, I would think that if she survived that ordeal, she probably would have been totally turned off by the poisonous, the poison of the Kennedy family, and realized that the socialism that they were promoting would have just totally destroyed the United States, not some great, great frontier that was going to put us into the 20th century, you know, pave the way to all kinds of greatness. It would have destroyed, it would have turned our country into a Detroit. And there's still some people, of course, that are enamored by the Kennedys that were horrified that this movie came out. But to turn back the clock a little bit, Chappaquiddick. Chappaquiddick is a little island, which is part of Edgartown, a town in on Martha's Vineyard. And Martha's Vineyard is an island off the Massachusetts Bay, about an hour or so from Cape Cod by boat, or just probably a short, I don't know, 15 or so minutes from by plane. So it was July, I think it was a Friday night, July 18th, is when Kennedy, he was having a party, and they rented a cottage. And they brought in six young ladies who were known as the Boiler Room Girls. These are young ladies, all ideologues, working for Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign. And I think the Boiler Room was a particular room that was windowless in the headquarters. And they were really diehard types. And after the assassination of Robert Kennedy, they, you know, they kind of scattered. And this was sort of a reunion. And there were also six married men. All these six young ladies were single, and there were six married men. Now, in the movie, it didn't look like there was any anything going on, all these wholesome young men and wholesome young ladies. That's the sort of the attitude. But they were drinking, and Ted Kennedy was on the island to be involved in a regatta, a yacht race. His cousin, Joe, was with him, Joe Gagin. And there were a few of other of his supporters, or I would call them flunkies. And after the race, now it looks like in the movie that Kennedy had a back brace that he took off, that he wasn't wearing the brace. Although we believe most accounts was he had the brace on, that means he couldn't have been able to swim. But anyway, so after the race, he goes to the party, a barbecue, and it's a little early evening, and according to a Kennedy's official account, it was 11:15, and he was taking Mary Jo to the ferry. And it's a very short ride across the channel, and she wanted to go back to her hotel. In the movie, he sort of pulls off and chats with her a little bit, asks her to work for him. And then a deputy had seen the car. They had pulled over. The policeman didn't pull him over. I mean, he just seen the Oldsmobile and got out and asked if he needed any help, and he sped off. And Kennedy, when he did drive, was known to be a very reckless and fast driver. And it was at that point that he went on the bridge. The bridge was a one-lane bridge that did not have any guardrails, a wooden bridge. And he, you know, the car plunges into the water, into the pond, about 8 feet of water. And Mary Jo was caught inside. Somehow Kennedy got out. Kennedy says he doesn't know how he got out. He does remember trying to rescue her, several attempts to, the car had turned over, and then he got out, and he's sitting on the beach, kind of contemplating what to do. And then instead of going to the Dyke House, which was just a short distance from the bridge, the light was on. He walked back to the cottage, which was about a mile and a half. He had passed several homes, and also the fire department. Now, it was a volunteer fire department, I'm guessing, but you could have rung the alarm, and the fire department could have come out. A rescue team could have come out. I'll talk about that a little bit later. He goes to the back to the party. He sits in the back of the one of the vehicles. I think it was his cousin Joe's rental vehicle. And he called the guys out, and he said, the bad thing happened. I don't think I'll be president. And now this is the alleged story. They go back to the bridge, And the two guys, the attorney, he was an attorney general, district attorney general for Massachusetts, federal attorney general, Paul Gagin. They make an attempt. Somehow Kennedy goes back to the mainland. He tells the two guys, Joe, his cousin, insists that he report this as soon as possible. He said that he would, and you go back and worry about the girls. And according to in the movie, they borrowed a little rowboat and they rowed across the channel. And Kennedy somehow gets back to his room, changes, takes a shower, goes to bed. The two guys go back to the party and they get drunk and fall asleep. So it's now the next morning. It's now 8 o'clock. But the official story was Kennedy swam across the channel, and then he went back to his hotel room. But to swim across that channel, it was a strong current. He was, if he was wearing a back brace, it would have been impossible for him to do that, to be able to swim. So that's another inconsistency in the story. And initially, Kennedy wanted to say that Mary Jo was driving, that he was not even in the car, that she drove and didn't know the road and so forth. The other thing, too, the ferry, according to this book, Teddy Bear, which I'll be talking about here, the ferry, they stopped running the ferry at noon, midnight. However, it was on call 24 hours, and they could have simply made a call, and they would have brought the ferry over. So they didn't have to swim across the channel or borrow somebody's boat. They could have simply just, summoned the ferry. And again, it's only 500 or 600 feet. It's not an hour or 2 hour ferry ride. It's a very short little ride. And so the next morning, in the movie, it looked like it was a father and son that were fishing, but it was actually two boys. And it was about 8:30, and they saw the vehicle submerged upside down. And one of the boys went to the house that was the closest house to the bridge, not that far away. The call to the sheriff was made. The sheriff shows up. The sheriff borrowed a pair of swimming trunks to look at the car, and he couldn't do much. And that's when they called the rescue team and Captain John Farrar. Now, Captain Farrar, he went on a tour on behalf of American Opinion Books, I think it was, to promote a book called Teddy Bear. Now, John, he didn't author the book, by the way, but he was promoting the book. John Farrar recovered Mary Jo's body, and he believed very strongly, without any question, that she didn't drown, that she suffocated. When the body was put on the, on the ground, there was only a little bit of water. And so it was in the movie, it portrayed this. In fact, probably one of the most grueling scenes is Mary Jo, as she's there was an air pocket, and she's calling out for Ted, and he's nowhere to be found. He's in his hotel worrying about his career while she is still alive. And there was enough air in that pocket to keep her alive for an hour or more. And while John Farrar couldn't say definitely that she would have survived had they called, had Kennedy simply called the police or called for help at that house that was 1,000 or so feet away from the bridge, there was an excellent chance, he said 90% chance or more, that she would have survived. And Kennedy claimed to be in a state of shock. And it was interesting, too. There was one account where he claimed to have a concussion, and he was taking sedatives for this. And in the movie, New York Times journalist reporter, Joseph James Reston, that had been following Kennedy around, he went back to New York to write a story, almost a scoop, and they say he's got a concussion, and he's taking sedatives. The doctor prescribed sedatives. And Reston had probably a little bit of knowledge of medical background, and he said, you don't give a person with concussion sedatives. That's the last thing you do. So it was another lie on top of another lie. So at about 8:30 or so that next morning, Saturday morning, Kennedy goes into the sheriff's office, and the sheriff was doing everything he can to help Kennedy, not asking him any questions, not asking any potential witnesses. They didn't talk to the girls, the boiler room girls. In fact, they got off the island as quickly as possible, Kennedy called up one of his lackeys. The guy flew in to the island, and he was able to get the body, get a get the body out as quickly as possible. And in the movie, it was New Jersey, but they actually lived, the Kopechne family lived in Pennsylvania, not New Jersey. I don't know why they did that in the movie, but that's how Hollywood is. Anyway, that's when Kennedy got all his guy like Ted Sorensen. Ted Sorensen was a speechwriter for John Kennedy and also the ghostwriter of Profiles in Courage, and I think maybe another book that John Kennedy allegedly authored. And Sorensen would do every can to cover up to, and then they brought in Robert McNamara, and I can't remember the name of the actor that betrayed him, but he's very well known. He was in a lot of different things, but I think he was the prison guard in Shawshank Redemption, real formidable looking guy, probably the nicest guy in the world, but his character. And Robert Strange McNamara was the Secretary of Defense under John Kennedy, because he was a traitor. He's the one that he was promoting world government, but that's another topic for another time. And they were doing their best to spin the story, and Kennedy ended up getting charged with leaving the scene of an accident. They actually were able to get an earlier court date. Kennedy pled guilty. He goes into court, gets a suspended sentence, gets his license suspended, and that's that. He's out of there, no questions asked, no autopsy. It was a despicable, disgusting event. In the movie, the cousin Joe, who was, I guess he was related through the mother, on the mother's side, I guess it was, and they were very close. And Ted Kennedy considered him almost to be like a brother. And the guy was an attorney, and he was probably the only guy that acted with any honor in this whole incident. He ended up becoming estranged from the Kennedy family, probably the best thing that he ever did. And I don't think he said much about it. He passed away in December, this past December, as the movie was still under production or post-production. I think in the movie it said that he had retired and lived a private life or what have you, but he had since passed away before the when the movie was released. He passed away. There's a lot of books about the subject, and John Farrar, when he was on a tour, and I'm guessing it was the middle of mid-1970s, John Farrar spoke to, he was on a radio show hosted by the former mayor of Los Angeles, Sam Yorty. And that particular interview is on our YouTube channel, Camp Constitution. It's about an hour long, and it's very well worth it. And I uploaded this to February of last year, and it was getting its share of views, but the last month or so, it's going crazy. We've got almost 130,000 views. I think a lot of people have seen the movie, you heard about the movie, and are looking in, you know, going into a little deeper, want to know more information. And, you know, John Farrar, he was right there on the, you know, he was right there. He was the first one to recover the body, and he was, you know, the cover-up. He was so well aware of the cover-up and pretty disgusted. He owned a scuba diving shop, and he would sell this book, Teddy Bear. Now, Teddy Bear was a book published by Western Islands. It was probably one of the first books to expose, and it's Teddy Bear, B-A-R-E. And the author's name is Zad Rust. And actually, that's not his real name. His real name is Prince Michael Sturza, who is a Romanian prince. He was a foreign minister. At this time, I think he was living in exile in the United States, and he was up in his either late 80s or early 90s when he wrote this. But it's an incredible account, and it's interesting is that at one point I had about 15,000 copies of this book. It was the last printing, and I didn't have it all at once. I had a friend that had stored in a warehouse in Pennsylvania, and another friend of mine who was a truck driver, 18-wheel over the road, refrigeration car, he'd get down there every so often and bring back 20 or 30 cases, and we would distribute them throughout the state of Massachusetts. And we did this year after year. It was interesting. The last case I have, I started selling a few on Amazon when when Ted Kennedy passed away in 2008, and because of the interest in this movie, the book has become very popular again. So if you go to Amazon you'll see this paperback version. I do have a couple of hardback versions, but I highly recommend it. Now, there's a lot of other books. Leo Dinsmore wrote The Chappaquiddick Cover-Up. That's an excellent book. In Over His Head by Gary Allen is another good book. There's Left to Die. So there's a number of books exposing this. But the Teddy Bear book, again, is one of the earliest books and, you know, an excellent book, a summary of what happened. The first chapter of the book, though, goes into some of the treacherous things that the Kennedy family was involved in, from John to Robert to Ted Kennedy. So I highly recommend the book. I hope you check it out. And also check out our video on our YouTube channel. In fact, you should go to our YouTube channel and subscribe and watch some of these videos. And I also have an audio version on the Podomatic account. If you go to Camp Constitution's Podomatic page, you can get, and it's a free download, and it's probably a little more handier than a video. There's something else that I wanted to talk a little bit about. Of course, the gun issue, that's something that's ongoing. And now, over the weekend, there was a shooting at a Waffle House. I believe it was in Pennsylvania. Some crazy guy walks in wearing nothing but a coat, no clothes underneath, and shoots four people. It's interesting that, say, over the weekend in Chicago, there's been about 15 or 16 shootings, but that doesn't make the news. For some reason, that's not part of the narrative. But when you hear about a shooting like this in a restaurant, it becomes national news. And the whole reason for this, folks, and make no mistake about it, is that there are people that want to have gun control. They want to do away with the Second Amendment totally. And they want to have gun confiscation. And I know people, oh, that will never happen. That will never happen. Well, as the, and it was interesting too, is the crime rate in this country has gone down dramatically, all categories, violent crime, assaults, robberies, what have you, except in some communities in the inner city. But we can't say that because that would be considered politically incorrect. So, and in fact, there are more crimes prevented. And some people estimate 2 million crimes that are prevented because of armed people. And there was a professor by the name of Glick from Florida, University of Florida, who was a liberal, who wrote a book called More Guns, Less Crime. And it was very fascinating, though, in states that have very large gun ownership per capita, the crime is very low. And you look like the state of Maine, where this show comes out, they actually have concealed carry laws, very, very easy to get a weapon in Maine. Vermont, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and all these states that have very high per capita gun ownership. And whatever that per capita is, almost everybody has. And you look at some people, obviously most people have more than one weapon or gun in their home. The crime rate's very low. You don't hear about drive-by shootings. You don't hear, there aren't gangs going around committing crimes and getting away with it, what have you. If you hear about a murder in Vermont, it's usually a crime of passion, and it's very rare. So why is it that the idea of having guns is somehow the problem, and it's the inanimate object that's the problem, not the person with the gun? And I know it's interesting, Michael Moore, the propagandist movie director, I get his tweets, and of course he's a big advocate of socialized medicine, socialism, and he's a big advocate of gun control. He did that bowling, I think it was Bowling for Columbine, and there he is demanding more gun control. At the same time, he's trashing Trump. Trump is this evil guy. Trump is awful. Trump is wicked, and what have you. Well, look at this for logic. They hate the president of the United States. They look at him as a Hitler. Of course, they have no trouble with Stalin, but they look at him as a Hitler. And they want to have Trump with more power to confiscate weapons and give this guy more power. I thought that was pretty interesting. I said, you really want gun control? You see, because if you really hate Trump that much, why would you want to give him unlimited power? So just something to mull over, folks. And the third topic I want to bring up is this Earth Day. Earth Day is a make I call it a communist inspired holiday. It goes back to 1970, and we have a Camp Constitution on our website. We have an article that was written by the late Gary Allen in May of 1970. It was probably written in April, but the cover date was May, of a magazine that's no longer in circulation. It was called Ecology, and Gary Allen goes to the root of Earth Day. It was April 22nd, is Lenin's birthday, and there's a reason for that. The cynical people behind it are communist and pro-communist, and they wanted to celebrate Lenin's birthday. So that's why it's April 22nd. It's, of all the days they could have used, they chose April 22nd. It isn't like something, some environmental issue happened on that particular day. But that's when Lenin was born, one of the most wicked men of the 20th century. People like Gaylord Perry, Paul Ehrlich, one of the communist folk singers. What's his name? It'll come to me. These were all people involved. Now, who was Paul Ehrlich? Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb. It came out in 1968. Well, Ehrlich was talking about by the mid-70s, the seas would be dead, that we'd have all kinds of starvation around the world by the late 70s because of the horrible environment. Pete Seeger, the folk singer, who was not just a liberal, but an out-and-out member of the Communist Party. if you look, want to get a copy of this article, which is a timeless article, you go to Camp Constitution's website, and you'll see a little menu. You'll see Camp Archives, Camp Items, and then you drop that down, you see Camp Archives. You click that on, and you'll see a Gary Allen collection, and you will find it under domestic issues. And if you have trouble finding it, just give me a call. Go to our website and contact us. Visit us on Facebook, our Camp Constitution page on Facebook. And I'm going to be writing a blog about this issue probably today or tomorrow in a short time. And I'll have a link to it also. So please avail yourself of this important article to help expose this lying fraud of being called Earth Day. By the way, I think we as Christians and people of faith have an obligation to be good stewards of the earth. We don't worship the earth, but we should be good stewards. And most of these Earth Day people, they're not interested in stewardship. You see these free Earth Day concerts, and in the wake of it, there's filth and litter and that's the kind of people who are promoting Earth Day. I live in the city of Boston. The mayor is enamored by this crap. The city council is basically a rubber stamp. It's like a Soviet Politburo. But Boston still is a relatively dirty city. You'd take a walk from here to the post office, and I live in one of the better neighborhoods of Boston. I mean, there's litter. You pick it up, it gets swept up, and then a day later, just as bad, broken glass. You go on the commuter rail and it's dirty, trash on the tracks everywhere. And you think, wait a minute now, these people are all greenies and globalists. You would think that the place would be spotless, but it's not, because the people behind us, with few exceptions, have no respect for private property and public property. And it isn't about cleaning the environment, making the environment, and by the way, which is a noble thing to do, it's all about power. It's a vicious power grab. They want to control the land. They want to, and they propagandize this stuff in schools, private and public. And instead of learning about stewardship and about the private property and why private property is so important, they learn about socialism and Marxism. Well, folks, thank you. Running out of time here. Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. Heard on WBCQ The Planet and many other venues. And until next week, may God richly bless you.